coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation. It's your host, Doug Hagman.
Welcome to Hagman. It is the Hagman Report for today. It is Tuesday, November 22nd, 2022. 59 years ago today, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I've got to tell you, in modern times, I believe those people alive, the majority of people alive today, who recall that, would say that that was the moment, the beginning of the coup, the present coup, that is, the formation of the coup. And I'm going to have some stuff for you on that. As we here at the Hagman Report have interviewed numerous people about JFK, the JFK assassination, the conspiracy attached to that, and of course, the role of the intelligence community in that particular assassination, murder, what have you. But first, I want to get into the people are fighting back. We must fight back. Okay. I showed you some of this yesterday. What is being, how can I put this? What is being not shown by any mainstream media, very little in the alternative media, is what's happening in Brazil. Look, they had their elections stolen from us just as we had in 2020. They're not taking it too well. They are being assaulted. The farmers are being assaulted down there. They're not taking it too well. Let me show you a brief 35-second, I believe, clip of what's going on in Brazil. Truckers have completely shut down the roadways and have suspended the export of all agricultural products. I'm telling you right now, the people are rising up. We must rise up and say no more. No more. Watch this. Video 6. For the radio listeners, you're hearing horns, obviously, but you're seeing trucks that are blocking the freeways in Brazil. You're seeing people cheering them on, of course. And this is in response to the crackdown or the theft of the election by a communist. I would urge everyone to pray for Brazil, to make sure you understand what's going on there. And we must copy this. I believe we have to copy this. By the way, what's going on in Arizona, the theft in Arizona, specifically with respect to Kerry Lake, the gubernatorial candidate Kerry Lake, and Katie Hobbs, the Secretary of State, of course, the one that certifies the elections, is unbelievable. The Assistant Attorney General in Arizona right now is pausing the certifications of the elections. And that's just causing the left to go absolutely apoplectic. I'm telling you right now. If there was a theme to today's show, outside of the exposing the various elements of the coup, I want to put this attached image, or the image, Eric, that's attached. I want to put this up on screen. And I want to deliver this message to the people who are listening for surveillance purposes. I think this is extremely important for people to at least understand, adhere to, and commit themselves to. I don't know, seriously, I don't know about you, but I've had it. I'm done. I'm over being pushed around. I'm 100% over this. Here this is, it's a meme or a posting by @real6million. I believe I found this on Gab. I'm not entirely certain. This is dated back October 6th. but it is so true. I'm going to read it now. And those watching can certainly see it on your screen. We are the ones you couldn't teach to hate their ancestors. We are the ones you couldn't teach to hate themselves. We are the ones you couldn't teach to work against the interests of their children. We are the ones you couldn't teach to celebrate faggotry and degeneracy. And we are the ones that are going to teach you a lesson. Now, to those who need to hear that, understand what each of those points mean, with specific emphasis on the last, because you will be taught a lesson. It may be your final lesson, but you will be taught a lesson. Until I can't suck air anymore, and until I'm down and 6 feet under, I guarantee you, I will work toward that end. That's a promise of mine. Let's go back 59 years. I've got a lot of current things to get into, but just so people that perhaps never saw this, or they weren't born yet, or were just born and not really cognizant of the facts, I want to hit a few things here about the JFK assassination, which I believe, like I said, kicked off the modern coup, what we're experiencing today. Let's go to clip one. This is As It Happened. Now, I didn't include the interruption from the daytime programming. I went right to the news, and then from there you can see it play out. This actually is like a 6-hour clip, but about a minute 20 seconds or so. Here it is.
It's going to be sketchy for some time, because you can imagine what is happening to every circuit, radio and telephone between the East Coast and Dallas, Texas at this moment. Obviously, the circuits are jammed. The information that we have, this is no time, obviously, for speculation. Facts are all that are warranted. Here is something else. It was impossible to tell at once where Kennedy was hit, but bullet wounds in Governor Connally's chest were plainly visible, indicating the gunfire might possibly have come from an automatic weapon.
There is this, Chet. Representative Albert Thomas, a member of the House of Representatives, said he was informed that President Kennedy and Governor Connally are both still alive after having been shot in an assassination attempt. This is from Dallas. It is the first word we have that they are, in fact, still alive. It is the first thing definitive that we have. As we say, we can give you only as much as we have. It is that both men were wounded by an assailant or assailants. It's not known who did it or why. And it was also reported from Dallas that it was not determined whether the Secret Service and Dallas police returned the gunfire that hit the president and the Texas governor. There is no word that the assailants have been captured or cited. Probably because the focus of attention now, understandably, is on the president and not so much on those who committed this act.
I have.
Now, about 6 years ago, by the way, that was just the initial broadcast from NBC News about word of the assassination. I find it very interesting, too, when you look at that and when you follow that through. The evolution of the story of the accounts, the eyewitness accounts, the capturing of Oswald, the disposition of JFK's body. And when you look back at that in the context or through the lens of current events, I think you'll see how things got to where they are today. When you can see the massaging of the news, of the elements of that incident, you can see how things got to where they are today. Now, 6 years ago, this platform had the ability, and in fact, we interviewed the man featured in the very iconic photograph, which everyone has seen. I know you've seen it. And that's a picture of JFK's limousine right after he was shot the third time, at least the third time, of Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent, climbing on the back of the limousine. I'm sure you're familiar with that image. He wrote a couple of books. Now, let me say this. I do not, absolutely 100%, do not agree with Clint Hill's assessment that this was a one man, one gun, non-conspiratorial operation. But the fact that we had him on, the reason we had him on, is because there's a human element to that story. And the human element, a lot of times we forget about that. And I'm guilty of that myself. We forget about the human element. Here's a man who is, for example, in this case, Clint Hill, charged to protect the first family, specifically Jacqueline Kennedy. And in so doing, found himself in the middle of history. Now, to me, his actions were heroic that day. I mean, anyone who can do what he did. And again, you remember that photograph. You'll see it here in a moment where he's climbing on the back of the limousine to push Jackie down, to collect the fragments of the president's skull as they're going at that point, 40, 60, 80 miles an hour down the road. And he's hanging on by his fingertips. He was on this show 6 years ago, telling his story about the human elements of the presidency. And again, I respect him in that regard. Now, I don't agree with him, but with regard to the entire incident. And you know, I wonder if his assessment has evolved or changed since the last time I spoke with him. I don't know. But here is, I think, an important 9 minutes from that program I'd like to play for you. Brought back a lot of memories, folks. Here it is right here, clip two.
Our guests tonight are two individuals, Clint Hill, a man, a Secret Service agent who served under five U.S. presidents, presidential administrations. He was Jackie Kennedy's personal Secret Service agent. And he with Lisa McCubbin, have three books, Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. And then two other books, Mrs. Kennedy and Me, that came out in 2012, and 5 Days in November, that came out in 2014.
And then you get in the cars and head into downtown Dallas.
The reception at Love Field was large. The president saw the numbers of people there. He immediately went over to them, started shaking hands. Mrs. Kennedy normally doesn't do that, but she did in this case. We finally got him into the cars, and we had flown our cars in, special cars for this motorcade. It was Secret Service car 100X. It was an open air stretch Lincoln. It had a capability of having a bubble on it, but that was only to be used. These were President Kennedy's directions. That bubble was only to be used in the event of adverse weather, such as rain or snow, or if it was so windy, it would affect Mrs. Kennedy's hair. Other than that, the bubble was to be off. And the bubble was off. So it had been raining in Dallas, but as soon as it was determined that that was stopping, they took the bubble off. And that was standard procedure. Wasn't anything special new for Dallas. So we got him in the car. We started into downtown Dallas. We had to get down to Main Street, where the majority of people were, because they wanted this maximum exposure motorcade. Purpose of the trip was to get as many people to see President and Mrs. Kennedy as possible. And so we got down to Main Street, and the crowds were real heavy, 10, 15, 20 deep on each side of the street. The driver of the presidential vehicle was keeping the car farther to the left as he would throw down the street to keep the president. He was in the right rear, away from the crowd. That put Mrs. Kennedy right up next to the crowd on the left-hand side. I would get off my position, which was on the running board of the car immediately behind the president. It's called a follow-up car. I would run up, get on the back of the car, and be as close to Mrs. Kennedy as I could to prevent anything from happening to her. And I did this 4 or 5 times as we traveled down Main Street. Now, I knew the president didn't want us up there, but I also knew what my responsibility was, and I also knew that if he asked anything or said anything, I'd be able to explain it to him. I had no fear of that whatsoever. So then we got down to Houston Street during the end of Main, had to turn right, because we had to get on the Stemmons Freeway to get us out to the trademark. And we took one, just drove one block on Houston and then had to go left on Elm Street. And that put us right in front of a building called the Texas School Book Depository. Now, the crowds had really dropped off. There weren't many people in that area compared to how many there had been along Main Street. We had been, as agents on the follow-up car, we had been surveying the buildings as we traveled down the street. Most of the buildings had windows open. There were people hanging out of windows. There were people on board, on fire escapes, on balconies, wherever they could be to get a better visual of President Mrs. Kennedy. There were 2 or 3 windows open on the Texas School Book Depository, but we saw nothing that looked dangerous or a problem for us. And we approached that. We had to make a very sharp left-hand turn onto Elm Street. The cars, we had to slow way down. We've been running 10 to 12 miles per hour. Now we had to go very, very slow to make this turn. And as we started to straighten out on Elm, which was going down toward a triple underpass underneath the railroad line, and so the roadway was kind of slanted. We were about 150 feet from the entrance from Houston. I was scanning the area to my left and straight ahead at that overpass, and all of a sudden I heard an explosive noise over my right shoulder. It came from the rear. I started to turn toward that noise, as did all the other agents. But I only got as far as the back of the president's car, because I saw what happened. I saw the president grab at his throat and start to fall to his left. I then realized this was a gunshot. At first, when I first heard the noise, I didn't think it sounded like a gunshot. But that was probably because there was echo in that area because of the buildings and the underpass. And so I then jumped from my position and started to run toward the presidential vehicle with the intent of getting up on the top of the back of it to form a shield there to prevent anything further from happening to either President or Mrs. Kennedy. As I jumped off the follow-up car, there was a motorcycle officer immediately to my left. I had to get between him and the follow-up car, which meant there was a lot of noise in that area. So later, the agents told me there had been a second shot at that time. I didn't even hear it.
Pause that for just 1 second, please. Just for the people watching on Rumble and Brighty on, the image that you see there, the man climbing on the back of the limousine, that iconic photo, that is the man talking as he was engaged in that activity in 59 years ago, 1963 now. That is Clint Hill. Just so you know. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Then as I approached the presidential vehicle, I was just about there, and there was another shot that rang out. This one I not only heard, I felt it, because it hit the president in the head. At that time, he had fallen farther to his left. His head was down, slanted somewhat, down in a downward position. And the bullet entered in the rear of the head, kind of low in the rear, and then exited just above the right ear and blew a portion of the skull there forward, still attached to the scalp, but material erupted out of that wound, blood, brain matter, bone fragments. And they got all over me, all over Mrs. Kennedy, all over the back of the car. when that happened, I was able to get a hold of the handhold on the car and get myself started to get up on the trunk. And just as I did that, she came out of the seat and climbed up on the back of the trunk from the seat position. She was trying to reach some of the material that had come out of the president's head. She didn't even know I was there. So I got a hold of her and I put her in the back seat. When I did that, the president's body fell to its left with his head ending up in her lap. The right side of his face was up. I could see that his eyes were fixed. I could see there was a hole in the skull and there was just no brain matter in that general area of the skull at all. So I immediately assumed it was a fatal wound. I turned and I gave a thumbs down to the follow-up car crew to make sure all the other agents knew how serious this was. And then I turned and screamed at the driver to get us to the nearest hospital. And he accelerated. The chief of police from Dallas, Curry, got in front of us in his car and led us to Parkland Hospital. I was wedged up on the top of the back seat. We were traveling upwards towards 80 miles an hour as we traveled down the Stevens Freeway to what turned out to be a Parkland Hospital.
Wow. Wow. You know, I've heard, and Joe, we've all heard your discussions, your previous interviews, but again, going back to 1975, I think it was 4 months after you left the Secret Service, 12 years after that day in 1963, you carried around a lot of guilt, a lot of internalized guilt that you could have done something differently that day. Personally, I think, well, who cares what I think, except to say I think that your actions were not only heroic, but nearly superhuman as you watch the Zapruder film and you see your actions. But that had to be just so remarkably tough for you that day. My goodness.
It ate at me over time, too, as well. I did have that very serious sense of guilt that we hadn't done the job we were charged to do. We'd failed in our mission. And so it became more difficult as time went on because it just ate at me.
Sure. All right. That was from 6 years ago now. I look younger now, don't I? Again, I played that only to address the humanity part of things, the human part of things. Look, the people who are attempting to take us down, to kill us, to enslave us, to take over the world, these people are ruthless. Now, Clint Hill, in my estimation, when he was a Secret Service agent, he was a guy, he was expendable. He was a guy there to do a job. And even perhaps through today, now he's still alive, he's 90 years old. All right. You have to wonder what he really thinks, if he would be allowed to, you know, to say what he really thinks, or maybe he believes there was no conspiracy. But again, that aside for the moment, with respect to that interview only, I don't agree with his assessment, but I am looking at the humanity part of things. And I would urge you to do the same thing. I mean, imagine yourself in that position, charged with taking care of protecting someone, and then watching the husband of the person you're charged with sitting just inches away, having his head blown off, practically blown off. It's horrendous. Eric the Tech and myself, we went down to Dealey Plaza. There's, I think, four images associated with this. I'd like to show you this as well, because Clint Hill and others were very insistent. Look, the shots came from behind. Well, when Eric the Tech and myself, what did you think, by the way, looking at that, Eric the Tech? I don't want to put you on the spot, but between the Zapruder film, other evidence, as well as being there, seeing the scene, most assuredly,
the Warren Commission was a piece of garbage, I think. And I think you'd agree with me on that.
Yeah, there's a lot that
is not
in the narrative.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll show a couple of pictures here from the time that Eric the Tech and I were down there. This is where the assassination happened, the first shot. In fact, there is a white X. I don't know if it's visible in this frame or not. There's a white X on the road where he was reportedly shot the first time. But this is looking at the grassy knoll. And to the left of that white structure is a wooden picket fence. And believe it or not, it's still up. The original fencing, the original picket fence is still up. And we'll show you that coming up. I think it's the next one, maybe. Okay, no, this is the wider version of the triple underpass as well as the grassy knoll. The grassy knoll, of course, is to the right. Okay, you can kind of see the X in this image marked on the road. But Eric the Tech and I, we are all through that area. And the spot, at least our collective reasoned investigative thoughts would be from this area, the next picture. That's an even wider picture. The next one from this area. This is actually, I'm going to say, between that white building and the triple underpass, overpass, whatever you want to call it. This is a fence that blocks off the railroad traffic and the parking area just on the other side of it. And this would be a good place for that shot to have come from. But having said all of that, the reason I brought this up, it is 59 years ago today. And with respect to the modern era in which we live, some people would mark 2001 as the day of the big coup. To me, the assassination of President Kennedy is that modern. Okay, we are going to really accelerate this globalist agenda. The people who are the people and the offspring of the people and associates of the people, the inbreds of the people that were responsible for that are the ones who are responsible for what's taking place today. And that would include all of the incidents running through 2001 and including 2001, 9/11, 2001. By the way, I thought it was very interesting because a lot of the evidence from the assassination was improperly disposed of. Now, as well, the assassination has ties to my hometown of Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm not going to get into that. It involves a doctor whose attorney is from Erie. But aside from that, for example, I'm just going to give you one example of the improper, two examples of the improper disposal of evidence or disposition of evidence. The first thing is when someone is murdered, I don't care if it's a president, I don't care who it is. When someone is murdered in a county, the county is responsible for conducting the investigation and the autopsy. It didn't happen here. In fact, the county medical examiner and the Secret Service almost came to blows over this very issue. There was some pushing of the gurney by Secret Service agents in the county medical examiner at the time to keep the body in Dallas County for the autopsy. Why is that important? Because once it's removed, evidence can be fabricated or altered. And that's precisely what happened. And this is what we're seeing today. The groundwork for everything that we're seeing today was laid many, many decades ago, including 59 years ago. But I thought this was pretty interesting. How many people know that Clint Hill got on the phone that day, the guy that we had on the show, he got on the phone that day to a local funeral home and said, hey, I want a casket, the best one you got, brought to the hospital. And they ended up getting this remember, this is 63. This casket, this bronze casket, the weight, I'm sure, was incredible. But for $4,000, that's what this casket cost, $4,000. Because Clint Hill said the family wants the best casket brought to the hospital. $4,000. It was a bronze casket. And when they put Kennedy's body in the, inside the casket, they had to line it with rubber and plastic because of the nature of the wounds. I won't get any more graphic. What happened to that casket? In clip 3, watch this. This is what happened. And does this ring a bell to anyone? Does this sound familiar to anyone? It almost makes me want to, of course, the time and water would wash away a lot of, well, all the evidence, but yeah, this is pretty interesting. Clip 3, watch this.
In 1965, a bill was passed to preserve anything associated with Kennedy's assassination. But because the casket was discarded and considered surplus, except to those, quote, morbidly curious, it was decided it should be destroyed. On February 18th, 1966, the casket was flown 100 miles east of Washington to a spot in John F. Kennedy's beloved Atlantic Ocean. At 10 a.m., the casket, drilled with holes and weighted with sandbags, was pushed into the ocean from an aircraft, where it quickly sank. Apparently, Kennedy had spoken about a desire to be buried at sea.
Yeah, you know, anything that you need discarded, disposed of, one good thing, one surveillance, or one countermeasure for forensic countermeasure is getting rid of it in the sea. Just saying, $4,000, your tax dollars, filled with sandbags, holes drilled, dropped in the Atlantic Ocean. Just in case you were wondering, I know I was. Eric the Tech, he was just absolutely going nuts trying to figure out what happened. Of course, there you go. All right. So here we are today, and we're going to teach you a lesson. And I'm saying that we are going to teach you a lesson to the people responsible for that incident 59 years ago, who are in power today, that line of people. I'm not saying those people, but I'm saying the people that have taken over the positions and expanded the positions. We're going to teach you a lesson. We, the people. You see Brazil? Brazil is going to look like a cakewalk. You're going to wish you were in Brazil. That is my belief. Now you might say, now, you know what, it's not going to happen that way. Americans don't care enough, but I think when you push Americans enough, and I'm going to tell you how far we're being pushed right now. It will happen. Video 4. I've seen a lot of videos featuring Yuval Noah Harari, haven't you? I mean, I'm so sick of this piece of garbage. In my view, he's a piece of garbage. I'm so sick of this guy. But I found this clip, and I want to play this because this, to me, says a lot in a very short period of time about this guy and about the agenda of these psychopaths who are trying to take over your life, my life, everyone's life, and the sycophants who back these people. But let's hear from Yuval Noah Harari in this video, which will be clip 4.
COVID is critical because this is what convinces people to accept, to legitimize total biometric surveillance. If we want to stop this epidemic, We need not just to monitor people, we need to monitor what's happening under their skin.
What we have seen so far, it's corporations and governments collecting data about where we go, who we meet, what movies we watch. The next phase is the surveillance going under our skin. We're now seeing mass surveillance systems established even in democratic countries, which previously rejected them. And we also see a change in the nature of surveillance. Previously, surveillance was mainly above the skin. Now it's going under the skin. Governments want to know not just where we go or who we meet. Above all, they want to know what is happening under our skin. What's our body temperature? What's our blood pressure? What is our medical condition? Now humans are developing even bigger powers than ever before. We are really acquiring divine powers of creation and destruction. We are really upgrading humans into gods. We are acquiring, for instance, the power to re-engineer life. I know that in recent years, we saw populist politicians undermining deliberately the trust that people have in important institutions like universities, like respectable media outlets. These populist politicians told people that, say, scientists are this small elite, disconnected from the real people. I mean, all this story about Jesus rising from the dead and being the Son of God, this is fake news. Humans are now hackable animals. You know, the whole idea that humans have, you know, this, they have this soul or spirit and they have free will and nobody knows what's happening inside me. So whatever I choose, whether in the election or whether in the supermarket, this is my free will. That's over. COVID.
You want to bet? You want to bet it's over? Did you catch that about Jesus, about it being fake news about his resurrection? Did you catch the total biometric surveillance that we're not going to have a choice? Says who? Says you? Here's my response. Well, actually, here's Joey Six Plugs, Joey Two Scoops, his response, or what should be his response to this piece of garbage. Here it is. Up. Is it really the audio? Because it was like really high. I'm talking to Eric over here. The audio on this clip is low. You might remember this. All right. Go ahead.
What a disgusting assertion for anyone to make. The press always asks me, don't I wish I were debating him? No, I wish you were in high school. I could take him behind the gym. That's what I wish.
See, the kind of lost its effect, impact, you know, because of that little break. But see, he's allowed to say that, right? He's allowed to say, I want to take him behind the gym, a reference to President Trump. But my goodness, we are not allowed to say anything like that. I want to take that Harari up behind the gym. And everyone like him. How's that? Am I allowed to say that? Hey, Biden can say that. I can say it too. But you talk about a psychopath, that Harari, who is Klaus Schwab's spiritual advisor. This is the spiritual advisor of all the globalists, saying you're not going to have a chance at all. One more thing I wanted to touch on. And this is video 7. This is a well-done video. But by the way, that was a well-done collage of Yuval Harari. Again, somebody that should not be even remotely able to walk down the street without, well, period. This is a good compilation because it addresses something that JFK addressed as well back during his tenure as president. And it's something for you to think about, especially when you hear today's news, when you hear today's op-eds, when you hear people talking today. This is clip 7. Have you ever wondered why deep state actors and media reporters, repeaters actually, use the word democracy instead of constitutional republic. This is a very well done video. I know it seems like it doesn't, it's kind of an outlier here, but not really, not when you look at the entirety of the program. Here it is.
A constitutional republic, not a democracy. The ideal of a democracy is universal equality. The ideal of a constitutional republic is individual liberty. A democracy always degenerates into dictatorship, which promises government-guaranteed equality and security, but it delivers nothing but poverty and serfdom for the people it robs and rules. America was founded as a constitutional republic to safeguard the liberties of the people against the tyranny of democracy or of one-man dictatorship. In this century, great strides have been made toward the goal of subverting our republic into a democracy. The foremost tactic of the subverters is subversion of language. By calling America a democracy until people thoughtlessly accept and use the term, the totalitarians have obscured the real meaning of our principles of government. A
I thought that was a really good explanation about the difference between a democracy and a constitutional republic. And I think it's important for us to use language, use the correct language. We are not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic. And that's what we should be known as, known by. As we enter into more of this coup, as we see the globalists just pushing us down again, whether it's the whether it's economically or from the food sector, from the water sector, as Steve talks about, whether it is with this biometric surveillance, with all of this, we're also fighting right now the moral fight, the spiritual fight, the biblical fight. One of the big things, and you're going to see this more and more. I'm telling you right now, you're going to see more and more headlines about this, is the Respect for Marriage Act. And this, in the show notes, this is page number one. The Respect for Marriage Act is an exercise in tyranny. And I thought this was a great article. This is in The Federalist, written by John Daniel Davison, published today. And I want to go over this because I think, again, this is extremely important. Think of Roe v. Wade, all right? And think of the so-called repealing of that. Think about the baker. Think about who refused to bake the cake for the same-sex marriage couple. Think about all, just think about what's happened since the Obergefell decision. And writes John Daniel Davison, it's not hard to game out what happens if the misnamed Respect for Marriage Act passes, codifying Obergefell and enshrining gay marriage in federal law. Everyone, including the dozen Republican senators who voted to advance this legislation last week, they know exactly what will happen. It's not some big mystery. And here it is right here. And you can read this, obviously, for yourself. What will happen is this. Christians, Jews, Muslims, and anyone else who dares maintain that marriage is a lifelong conjugal union between one man and one woman. And I believe that 100%. It's one man, one woman. It's not Steve and Robert. Okay. It's a guy and a woman. Do we need further explanation on this? I don't think so. But what's going to happen is this. Christians, Jews, Muslims, anyone else who dares maintain that marriage is this lifelong conjugal union between a man and a woman, which, by the way, was the definition of marriage for thousands of years until the U.S. Supreme Court, and I like how he writes this, descended from Mount Sinai with Obergefell v. Hodges inscribed on stone tablets. Well, anyone who dares say that, hey, a marriage is between a man and a woman will be branded a bigot and driven from the public square marketplace. And he goes on, anyone who owns a small business related to the wedding industry, photographers, bakers, website designers, venue owners, caterers, florists, will be sued into oblivion if they refuse services to same-sex couples. Religious colleagues and universities will lose their tax-exempt status. Religious institutions of every kind, if they hold to their teachings and traditions about marriage, will face this onslaught from the Department of Justice and the federal bureaucracy. This is why, in part, we talk about the weaponization of the DOJ. This is part and parcel. Well, it's one of the communist goals. It's one of the one world order, new world order, communist goals. To paraphrase Orwell's famous line, if you want a picture of the future under this Respect for Marriage Act, imagine a boot stamping on Jack Phillips' face forever. And you might be saying, well, who's Jack Phillips? He's the baker, the Christian baker. This exercise of power and the vigorous crushing of the dissent is the entire purpose of the proposed law. There it is. Let me say that again. The exercise in power and the vigorous crushing of dissent is the entire purpose of the proposed law. Please understand what the intent here. It's not about the spoon. It's never about the spoon. To paraphrase myself from previous shows, there can be no other possible justification for it, he writes. Michael New, this assistant professor at Bush School of Business in the Catholic University of America, recently told the Daily Signal that Catholic colleges and universities in particular might face ruinous lawsuits and loss of federal funding if the bill is signed into law. Suppose a Catholic college refused to allow a same-sex married couple to live in college-owned graduate student housing for families. They might be subject to all sorts of litigation, he added. Such a college might lose its nonprofit status. Their students might lose eligibility for financial aid, and their faculty might lose eligibility from research grants and from government agencies. Well, of course that would happen. The left, the communists, and the left-wing activists hear these kinds of concerns from people like New and think, good, let them face ruinous litigation. Let them lose funding. Ghettoize them. Crush them. Grind their institutions into dust. They deserve it, the bigots. Haven't we heard this, too, about the injections and about the masks? And what else have we heard this about? I mean, think about this. This is the template. Now they want to codify this. And the 12 Republicans? The 12 so-called conservatives who voted for this? Let me just grab this here. Do you know who they are? Let me name them. May I? Hang on a second here The 12 Republican senators who voted for the same-sex marriage bill include Collins, Susan of Maine, which is one of the three GOP senators who work with a group of Democrats to spearhead the legislation and garner additional Republican votes. She supported multiple bills supporting the gay rights, including in 2004 when she voted against a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. Rob Portman of Ohio. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina. Roy Blunt from Missouri. And by the way, he's going to retire in just a few weeks at the end of his term. He said he supported the bill after the legislation's sponsors added religious liberty protections. My backside, okay? There are no religious, will not be any religious liberty protections. Richard Burr, who's retiring in January as well. He's also from North Carolina. Burr voted back in, 10 plus years ago to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Although he previously voiced opposition to gay marriage. See, I guess he evolved. I guess he grew up. Senator Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican from West Virginia. It's interesting because Capito previously argued that the Supreme Court, the Obergefell decision in 2015, prohibiting same-sex marriage bans should have been left to the states. You think? I mean, the God of the Bible defined what marriage is. How friggin' dare you redefine what God has already defined? Just saying. Mitt Romney, mittens. Yeah, wow, that's a surprise. He announced his support for the bill earlier on Wednesday. Again, himself stressing the new version's inclusion of religious liberty protections. Folks, this is no, and hell no. You don't understand. It will offer no religious protections in practicality. This is a way to bring down the culture of this country even further than it's already brought down. Dan Sullivan of Alaska, another mope who voted for this. Senator Todd Young of Indiana. Good Lord, I'll tell you what. In 2016, Young voted in support of an amendment that upheld former President Obama's executive order banning discrimination based on sexual orientation. In September, Young said, yeah, well, I'm talking to my constituents about it. Apparently, he talked to all six of his, let me quote this, article, faggotry friends. Okay. And then you have Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. Help me, Rhonda. I'm referring to the song, not Rhonda. But look, if they're going to support this bill, though, do they have to pretend rights, as written in the Federalist, do they have to pretend that we're all too stupid to understand how this will work? Does Dan Sullivan, the second worst U.S. senator from Alaska, who once supported a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage in the long ago of 2014, really believe that the Respect for Marriage Act makes important advances in religious liberty? No, it's a ruse. It's a pretext. How about Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who 10 years ago, as Speaker of the State House, supported a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage in his state? Does he really think the anemic amendments he and other GOP senators offer the bill will advance religious freedom and age well? Hell no. No. See, these people are laughing at us. They think we're stupid. All the Republicans who voted to advance the bill last week issued some version of the nonsense Sullivan and Tillis spouted. None of them believe a word of it. They just hope you buy it. End of story. But you don't have to. A guy by the name of Roger Severino, Heritage Foundation, helpfully walked through these specious claims one by one, explaining why they're wrong. And I'm going to hit this hard. Okay, No, the bill will not provide religious institutions with meaningful protections. Yes, the bill certainly could be used as a basis for the IRS to deny tax-exempt status to religious organizations that don't toe the line on gay marriage. Yes, it could also be used to deny grants, licenses, or contracts. No, the weak language about preserving the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is not enough to prevent harm to religious liberty, and so on. Folks, this will be up at HagmanReport.com. You can read about it. And why did I press so hard with this? Especially today, 59 years, when I opened up with the fact that, number one, we're sick of the crap you're pulling, and you're going to be taught a lesson about this, and then went into the Kennedy assassination. Citing not just the conspiracy, the start of the coup, but referencing the humanity. Because I do believe that the humanity part of things, as much as it's God-given humanity, and I believe it to be good, tends to skew our objective analysis of things. If you think about that, that hopefully that makes sense to you. There's one more thing. You know, the media is still trying to trick Americans about Hunter Biden, about his lies, about the Biden crime family. We don't have time to play the video, but if we can just show the page. This is from Fox News. Folks, I'm telling you, the Hunter Biden hard drive, I'm telling you right now, this is far from being over, and it will be used in part to take down Joe Biden. Perhaps give him an excuse to step down or any number of things. But the ticket, the leadership of the United States as it stands in 2022 will not, in my estimation, will not be the same in 2024. And I'm talking about Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. The link to that article will be, and there's a video embedded in there. It'll be at HagmanReport.com. Open up the show page for today and look at it. But here is the bottom line on all of this. Oh, and yes, I'm sure I'll get emails on this. You can watch from, from JFK to 9/11, A Rich Man's Trick. I mean, I've seen all of these videos. I understand, okay? I fully understand. I've read numerous books about the JFK assassination, as well as 9/11 and everything in between and subsequent to and even before. But here is, you know, the thing. Here's the thing. We must be done being, excuse the expression, being bent over without lube, okay, and saying, you're going to take this. Here's what we have planned for you, and you're going to like it. You're not going to own anything in 2030, but you're going to like it. You're going to eat fake meat, and you're going to like it. Now, it stops now. It stops here. It stops with us. You're not going to burden our children with this. You're not going to enslave our children with this, us or our children. Once again, in closing, and I cite at real 6 million on social networking. Don't know this individual. Don't know anything else this person posted. But I agree with this. We are the ones you could not teach to hate their ancestors. I don't hate mine. I don't hate our founders. And we'll never teach my children that. We are the ones you could not teach to hate themselves. We are the ones you could not teach to work against the interests of their children. And in my case, my grandchildren. And I know their parents have got their children covered, I'm telling you. We are the ones you could not teach to celebrate faggotry and degeneracy. But most importantly, folks, and I want to drive this home, we are the ones that are going to teach you a lesson. With that, I bid you adieu. 59 years after the modern coup in the JFK assassination. May God bless each and every one of you until tomorrow. Good night.